Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to be with you on this Thursday, December the 13th. And hope you will join in as we talk about guns and gun violence this hour, and whether more or less gun control could be the answer, or what can be done to stop incidents like the Omaha mall shooting last week, or the shootings at two religious facilities in Colorado on Sunday, or then on Tuesday of this week, the shooting of six teenagers at a school bus stop in Las Vegas. What's going on here? Why is this happening? What can be done to stop these crimes from taking place? And is this happening more and more, or is that just our perception? We will talk about what we should do to reduce gun violence, and we will ask our guest sociologist what he thinks the answer is, and welcome your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Stan Stojkovic, the dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it seems when it rains, it pours, when it comes to these types of shootings anyway. We have the gun violence in a mall, at a church, at a missionary school, and a school bus stop in Nebraska, Colorado, in Nevada, all in the matter of a week. So what do we do besides shake our heads?
Well, we have to recognize, first of all, that these still are fairly rare events. They're tragic, obviously, events, but they're not real common events. And I know that that's unsettling to a lot of people, but we have to put it in a proper perspective. Individuals who have mental health issues, who have violence issues, who ultimately culminate in performing these kinds of activities, or these tragic events, are not individuals who clearly are the run-of-the-mill persons. They have long histories, typically, of mental health problems. They have issues, in some cases, of substance abuse and violence in their past. And it's real difficult, very difficult for criminal justice people as well as mental health professionals to predict with any accuracy. But having said that, there are things I think you can do to try to minimize these rare events.
Yeah, like what?
Well, initially, coordinating information, getting people to know who these people are and sharing that information with other people, other agencies. Excuse me. We know, for example, in a lot of the university shootings that occurred over the last couple of years, we had individuals who knew things about the shooter, who knew things about his behavior and his erratic behavior. But what we didn't have is a good system of coordinating, get that information to people who need to know that information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Professionals call that threat assessment, trying to find out what the threat assessment would necessarily be. If we could improve that, we could help ourselves in even these kinds of cases that, again, are very, very rare.
Yeah. Rare as they might be, are we seeing more of these days? Is this type of, mass shooting on the rise?
Not necessarily. I mean, in the history of this country, you've got to remember there's always been a lot of violence, and gun violence has been somewhat normative in this country, and it peaks and valleys, and you've got to remember that the worst, for example, university shooting that occurred at Virginia Tech last year, you know, prior to that, one of the worst ones was back in 1965, which was over 40 years ago. And so we've had, obviously, a number of these, but to suggest that they're regular or common would be, I think, a misstatement.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder if these shooters are spurred in part by the publicity given to others.
Well, in part, you hear that, but that's hard to confirm. Oftentimes what runs as a link or as a common thread across these people are serious mental health issues, issues that have not been dealt with or dealt with in an erratic or inconsistent fashion. And again, poor communication and coordination of information. Many people are led to believe that because people have these certain kinds of issues, that we as a society have limited rights or limited role in trying to assess and assist those people. And that's just not correct. I've heard so many people say the law prevents us from doing X, Y, and Z. And in many instances, that's just not correct.
Yeah. Well, besides assessing and assisting these people with the mental health issues, is there anything else in terms of public policy, specifically when it comes to the weapon being used, the gun, that should be considered?
Well, you know, we've tried that, and for many, many decades, the debate has raged on about gun control, for example, as a broad response to this kind of problem. Gun control has all sorts of potential benefits, but it also has all sorts of potential problems. And everything from product liability issues to controlling bullets to possibly trying to train and educate people more about the usage of guns. It seems simple, but it becomes a very complicated political process, but also a practical process of trying to implement these types of laws. Never lose sight of the fact that in this country there are about 200 million guns and about 100 million illegal handguns. And so you're talking about 300 million guns that have been circulated across the country. It's at a point right now where there's so many guns, it'd be very, very difficult to have, for example, a blanket ban on guns. This would never work. Would not work, I don't think, politically, but just from a practical point of view as well. So we have to sit down and think about, are there other ways for people to use this product in a safer way? And how can communities ultimately support safe education about the usage of guns?
We're talking with Stan Stojkovich, Dean of the School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, about how we control or can reduce or prevent gun violence in this country. Following a few high-profile shooting sprees across the country in the past week or so, at that Omaha Mall, two religious facilities in Colorado, and most recently at a Las Vegas bus stop on Tuesday, where six young people were all shot, all survived that Las Vegas shooting, but one was in critical condition as of late yesterday. Why is this happening, and why do these types of shootings seem to continue to happen? What, if anything, can be done with public policies to prevent or reduce events like this? We welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or talk at WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, 18 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, December the 13th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. State of Wisconsin residents think health care is the most pressing issue after taxes. And after 4, Ben and his guest will discuss the Badger Poll's findings when it comes to health care. What kind of health care system do we in Wisconsin want? We'll find out after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking about guns and gun violence this hour in the aftermath of the mall shooting in Omaha, the church shootings in Colorado, and another shooting at a bus stop this week in Las Vegas, wondering whether there's anything that could and should be done to prevent or reduce shootings like this. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. Our guest is Stan Stojkovich, Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. And our first caller is Carrie in Augusta. Hi, Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I guess my question is that I'm not familiar with the most recent shootings. It seems, or I am familiar, but I'm not familiar with where those shooters are accessing their weapons. It seems like they're young adults that are the shooters, and I'm just questioning where they're getting hold of these weapons. And it seems like a lot of the shootings that have been at the schools, at the university level, all of those are young adults. And again, where are they accessing them? And I guess I go back to kind of the basic question, and I know it's a difficult one to deal with, but that parenting part. I mean, when people question why people drink, well, do they have access to alcohol? Why do kids smoke? Well, do they have access to cigarettes? And I guess I have the same question with regard to weapons.
Dean Stojkovich.
Excuse me. Well, I think that's a very good question in terms of what are the access points. We know with guns that there are multiple access points. If you look at a number of the shooters, for example, the shooter in Omaha, the Omaha Mall, that gun was one of his relative's guns.
Mm-hmm.
And he had taken that gun apparently from his relative. I believe it was his uncle. and got access to that. We have access through mail order. If you look at Mr. Choi in the Black Virginia Tech shootings, he had access. And in fact, purchased that gun through a store in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And was able to get that weapon. So the point of access, there are multiple access points. Over the years, probably the last 20 to 25 years, there's been legislation introduced both at the federal level and in some cases at the state level to try to control those access points. More often than not, that legislation has not worked and has not passed. And everybody is aware of the lobbying efforts of various groups like the National Rifle Association, pro-gun lobbies, as well as critics of the gun system, and all have worked in the political process to try to change the laws to reflect their interest. And right now, there are multiple access points. Coupled with what I said earlier, you've got already a huge supply of guns out on the streets. And as a result, getting guns is really not a difficult issue. And trying to control that at this point in time is enormously difficult, not only in the political process, but I think ultimately as a practical consideration.
Yeah. Robert Hawkins was the shooter at the Omaha Mall, and it he used an AK-47, too, in that shooting. But, yeah, I thought it was a relative. I thought it was the stepfather, but it very well could have been the uncle where he stole the gun from that relative. The other cases, I don't think we know. It says here the Colorado, the young man in Colorado who shot and killed four people on Sunday, had three guns with him at the church, including a Bushmaster assault rifle. He fired 26 rounds from the rifle and one from a handgun, and he had two more guns in his car. That young man was shot by a security guard and then shot himself and took his own life after he had been shot and wounded by a security guard. I had heard some talk, Dean Stojkovic, on, you know, I guess whether anybody in that mall would have had a gun in a concealed carry situation, whether those types of laws would, if not prevent the incident itself, at least reduce the number of deaths that could happen by somebody shooting the shooter.
Well, that's a hope and a prayer. The fact of the matter is concealed laws, and most states in this country allow you, a vast majority, overwhelming number, except for Wisconsin, allow you to carry those types of weapons. The fact of the matter is a small percentage of the electorate or the public actually carry guns. And the reality is all you need is one person who goes awry and does what we've seen happen recently in these various social settings. So I'm not sure that necessarily would be an answer to this, because largely that's pretty mythical. The fact of the matter is the thing that, again, ties these people is severe mental health issues. It's really trying to identify these people. People who know these individuals know that they have these problems. And the question is, what is the best way to deal with this problem? Because we can deal with appropriate medications, appropriate intervention. We can help people. We don't want to demonize people who have these problems, yet we can deal with the people who ultimately have issues that we have to address, because we don't know. We're not sure. Most people who are obviously suffering from severe mental health issues do not become violent, do not exhibit this extreme behavior. So it's a very difficult to pick out that one person who ultimately might wind up down the road, but oftentimes we have many signs that the threat is very high.
Mm-hmm. Now we go to Chad in Marathon. Hi, Chad, you're on the air.
Hi, I guess I disagree to a point with the speaker that having concealed carry or other people to help a threat that occurs is a myth. As we saw in Colorado, one of the persons there was the security guard, was actually just a concealed carry holder that was volunteering time. I'm a deputy sheriff in counties in Wisconsin. These issues happen very, very quickly. And one of the issues that does seem to also pop up is that they also happen in gun-free zones that are created. You don't see these shootings that happen in areas where usually there are a lot of guns that are placed or there are people that are carrying concealed. I think if people start standing up for themselves, taking a more of a mentality of defense, being aware of their surroundings, of things that could go wrong, I think we would, be stronger towards helping to solve these problems once they occur. Now, so that's basically a reaction towards when they do happen. Obviously, some kind of prevention would also be nice, but it's an issue that, I guess, if that doesn't happen, something needs to be done before the person continues to kill a lot of people. And like I said, I believe that concealed carry is a very strong issue that could help that.
Dean Strykovich?
Well, I mean, that's a view, and that's a view that has been expressed by many people. The fact of the matter is these events are incredibly rare again, and secondly, there's no evidence to support that. The reality is that the data on this and the studies that look at this are highly ambiguous and in many cases are flawed. It's very difficult to make a definitive statement that if we were to give people more guns or people had access to more guns in a legal way and had the appropriate training, and there's all sorts of provisos here, that would necessarily have stopped this. I don't think that there's any evidence to really, in the long term, to support that. It is also why the attendant problems associated with carry and conceal, that most professional police organizations don't support such initiatives. They support better communication, they support supporting the police and ultimately trying to do their job. But I think that it's not just a police issue, it's clearly a larger issue about what's the best way to deal with people who are in crisis. And giving everybody weapons and saying that that's going to be a panacea solution, there just isn't any evidence that supports that.
Yeah, keep on losing a caller who wants to talk about the Las Vegas shooting, and since he just dropped off again, I'm going to... he wanted to make a point that shooting occurred in a very high crime area. He's familiar with Las Vegas. You just want to talk about, I don't know, the conditions where these shootings occur?
Well, a lot of these conditions, I mean, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem. I mean, there's no set type of place that you can really identify where you are more safe or less safe. And again, because of the rarity of the event, it's hard to predict what setting would necessarily be a place. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, there are things I think you can do, particularly in school areas, that it can make places safer.
Okay, like what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Things like, for example, again, better communication in the system. But in high schools, you can close off. Usually you only have one building or two buildings. You can close off buildings. You can have people communicate more effectively. You can communicate prior to the event about kids who are having problems. In larger settings where it's more wide open, for example, like a university, a major university like UW, it'd be enormously difficult to use those kind of tactics to try to control this issue.
Yeah, in this Las Vegas shooting, they did overnight or yesterday arrest a one shooter. They believe two were involved. One of the alleged shooters, 18-year-old. The other, they believe, I think, the Las Vegas police say the shooting stemmed from an earlier fight at high school over a girl. So in this particular case, maybe these kids did have mental health problems, but this was a fight over a girl.
Well, in those particular cases, it may not be a mental health problem or an issue. It may be. We need to learn more about that particular event. But in the extreme shootings that we've seen, like the general in Omaha, clearly there were mental health issues that he was actually trying to deal with.
Yeah.
But that clearly did not lead to the outcome that the mental health professionals desired, nor what he desired. Many of these people take their lives subsequent to the shootings. I mean, these are people in huge distress. That's not to obviously relieve them of the responsibility.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, trying to get a handle on this at this point in our country's history is going to be enormously difficult because of the availability.
We will talk more about that after we check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:36 on this Thursday, December the 13th. We are talking about gun violence and what, if anything, can be done to prevent or stop the recent type of high-profile shooting that we've seen in the past week. Three different incidents. We had this shooting at the Omaha Mall last week, two religious facilities in Colorado on Sunday, and then most recently a little bit different type of shooting, but still a mass shooting nonetheless at a Las Vegas bus stop where six young people were shot, all survived. Why is this happening, and why do they continue to happen? What, if anything, should be done in terms of public policy to prevent or reduce events like this? We welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest, who is Stan Stojkovic, Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. John in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, John, you're on the air.
I was going to suggest two technological things that I think the government could help with. One is, I think there's a technology out there where you have to have a ring, and the ring has to be on the hand that's using the gun. And if there is no ring present, the gun doesn't work. So if you're in a fight with a burglar or something and he wrestles the gun out, it won't work. Or if your nephew steals your gun and wants to use it for something else, it won't work because he doesn't have the ring. Also, they could put a high tax then on guns that don't use this technology, and then use the income from that tax to buy back the guns on the street that don't use this technology. So we could get that technology out there. I think that would reduce a lot of the violence because a gun would only work for the person who purchased it. But in the case of a lot of the violence that's going on now, that probably wouldn't have helped. Well, I guess that the guy in Omaha stole the gun from his uncle, in which case, if he didn't have the ring, the gun wouldn't have worked. But another thing that government could do, I think, is if you look at, like, as an example, I think it is eBay, you rate buyers and sellers, and you get some idea as to the integrity of the buyer or seller. I would like to see complete transparency so that anybody who buys a gun, it gets put on Internet, and I can look up my friends or neighbors or somebody I think who's unstable that I would be a little leery about, and just see if they have a gun and how many guns they have. And if they also then allowed an anonymous response so that I could tell the government that I really think there might be a problem with this. And the police could keep these records, and if you have somebody who gets 1,000 responses from different people saying they don't think they're stable, that we can take advantage of the public and their knowledge, their personal knowledge of individuals, to flag somebody.
Yeah, thanks, John. Interesting ideas, the unique ideas. I'd never heard of this ring technology. Have you, Dean Stojkovic?
Yes, there is all sorts of technology, and the caller brings up a host of issues that would take us many, many hours to dissect and to explain. There are, I think, a couple of concerns that I would have. One, technological fixes oftentimes create other kinds of problems. That doesn't mean, however, that we shouldn't pursue them and pursue them in earnest where we think they may be appropriate. But technological fixes by themselves usually don't provide the answer in many of these cases. Secondly, when you start talking about citizens reporting on other citizens, whether you use the Internet or other kinds of modes of expression or communication, that can be valuable, but that can also lead to a whole history of abuse. And we have a whole history of actually those types of things happening. It's best, however, for mental health professionals to be able to conduct threat assessments and to work with people and to get information from people so we can identify them. Usually we know well in advance people who've exhibited extreme forms of violence in their past, there is something wrong, and we need to communicate this. Now, regarding attacks and putting attacks on these weapons and trying to get buybacks, these ideas have been proposed for many decades, and for various reasons they've been opposed by various interests. Buyback programs tend not to get you many guns. They tend to get you very small number of guns, and most of those guns don't really work anyway. So the utility of that is oftentimes questionable. It's laudable that people do that, but on the other hand, its impact, its net effect is very minimal.
Thank you very much, John, for the call. Agnes in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Agnes.
Yes, I would like to address the issue of our children growing up thinking guns are toys, being given toys, toy guns to play with, and growing up in a culture that guns are toys. And that would include, of course, nowadays, video games and arcade games and all that kind of thing. When we were children, my father was a hunter, and guns put meat on the table. Although, yes, my brothers did play with toy guns. But it was a whole different culture because that was back in the 40s and 50s. But this whole issue of children playing with guns, toy guns.
Now, what about that?
Well, there is ambiguous evidence about the impact of this. It's hard to study this, but the fact of the matter is that this has been a culture of violence since the inception of this country. And people have had access to the guns, fairly easy access to guns, historically in this country. But having said that as sort of an introduction to this response, I do think that there is something to be said about people glamorizing violence and guns and the use of weapons. You know, if my personal predilection or my personal choice was public policy, nobody would have a gun. But that's not reality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to have guns around me. I know how to use weapons. I've had them in my past. But the fact of the matter is, I think that guns bring on more problems than they bring on benefits.
Did you have a toy gun when you were a kid?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
So did my husband. And his Davy Crockett hat too. What about giving toy guns to kids at Christmas time? Is that something that glamorizes or makes gun violence okay?
Well, at one level it does, but to suggest that in a linear way leads toward the extreme forms of violence is probably very problematical. So, I mean, it may contribute to the notion that having guns is okay, and for people who support that view, that, you know, listen, that's my right, and they may make a Second Amendment argument. I think it's a fallacious argument, but they may make that argument. The reality is that we still have a right as a society to try to best control this product, to try to do things. And believe me, smarter minds than I have looked at this for many, many years, trying to come to some answer, and there are no easy answers to this. Now, I like the idea of a previous caller that maybe technology can provide us some assistance. But again, to think of it as the solution, I think, would be a mistake.
Joe in Bayfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. This is somewhat related to Agnes's call in that I traveled to Bhutan 3 years ago. And if your listeners don't know, it's a small kingdom, kind of like out of fairy tales, run by an autocratic but very kind king. And last year, he allowed television in, and their rate of violence went way up. I guess my feeling is very basic. I don't know that it's a solid solution, but somebody has to address, or more than we are now, the amount of violence that our children and our adults see on television and in the media.
Mm-hmm. What about that?
Well, that's been a common concern, and I would never minimize the fact that, you know, TV is there for a reason, and advertisers pay millions of dollars to advertise their products, so they must get something back from it. It does have an impact, particularly with certain types of people who may already have a predisposition or are suffering from serious mental health issues. The fact of the matter is that in this country, politically, that would never fly. We don't have a benevolent dictator as part of our governmental structure. And, you know, people have said for many years that part of the cost of freedom is that some people will exercise that freedom incorrectly and inappropriately, and it will lead to tragic outcomes. And the political process is an important variable that we have to understand. And I think that when we look at that process, it's been very, very difficult for our country to come to consensus about controlling weapons like we control dog food.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of issues associated with that. If I had my personal preference again, I would have more gun control. But again, I'm an N of one. This is a society of 300 million people. There is a political process. And clearly the consensus has been to stay away from total control of these weapons.
We're talking about guns and gun violence this hour and whether we need any more changes in public policy to prevent or reduce gun violence, talking about this in the aftermath of the mall shooting in Omaha, the church shootings in Colorado, and another shooting this week on Tuesday in Las Vegas where six people were shot at a bus stop. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. What do you make of all of this? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. 12 minutes before 7 o'clock, coming up after 7. The Fed has cut interest rates for the third time in about 3 months. What does this mean for our wallets? We'll talk with financial advisor Kevin McKinley coming up after 7 o'clock about money moves we might want to make right now or might want to avoid. We are talking about gun violence and controlling gun violence with Stan Stoykovich, Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, and Eva in Lake Geneva is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering if any research shows that this type of high-profile crime is caused by especially TV coverage, not so much this type of program, but does the crime become high profile because the person expects to be covered extensively on TV? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question. There is no systematic evidence that would suggest that's the case. But police are oftentimes worried about what they call copycat people, individuals who see something on television and then obviously try to emulate that. Does that happen? Yes, but that too is fairly rare. We have to know that, again, these kinds of events are rare events, and that they usually are committed by people who have serious physical and or mental health concerns. So to suggest that the copycat thing is a normative thing really would be, I think, incorrect.
Yeah, the teenager in the Omaha Mall shooting did leave a lengthy note that didn't say specifically what he was going to do, but was apparently a suicide note, where he did make some sort of reference about going out in a blaze of glory.
Well, you know, that's sort of a common phrase, and I think has been used many, many times. Here was a man who was enormously troubled and also tried to get some mental health help and was in mental health settings and was on medication and was off medication and just enormously difficult to try to predict who this person's going to be. Because most people who go through that situation clearly are never violent. They never form, get to a place where taking their lives or taking the lives of others is the ultimate solution. So it's just enormously difficult. I don't have a quick, easy answer. And I know that that's very frustrating to people, but that's the reality.
Yeah. Thanks, Eva. Scott in Black Creek. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, I'd like to just say that I do agree with your guest in a lot of issues. And until people start realizing this is a mental violence, not gun violence, because if they were going to come in and kill a bunch of people, they could do it with gas bombs and everything else. The other thing is that I wish our governor would finally realize that just because they're having a problem in Milwaukee, that doesn't mean he has to punish the rest of the state by concealed carry by not giving us the right to carry it. They could also control that by education and everything else. Now, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
I'm all for education. I think that how to use any kind of product makes a lot of sense. And since I don't think politically eradicating guns is practical or politically possible, I think education is the best route. The fact of the matter is we don't have enough people who will provide the education to individuals. Now, again, getting back to carry and concealed, it's just that most people will decide not to have a gun. And so its impact on these kinds of events would probably be very, very minimal, and we don't have any evidence to suggest that allowing that necessarily makes you any safer. And in fact, in some states, the rates of violence are still very high, even though you allow people to carry weapons this way. I think walking down that road as a solution to this problem is very limited. And as a result, I just don't see it as a beneficial thing in dealing with this problem.
Yeah. He brought up that it's not necessarily the gun. You could kill a lot of people with a bomb. And I suppose that's true. We had that incident not so long ago where the guy walked into a Clinton campaign headquarters in New Hampshire with saying he had a bomb strapped to him. Again, someone who said, I have mental health problems and I'm having trouble getting help.
Well, the fact of the matter is making a bomb is a little bit more difficult than having a weapon that you can easily discharge bullets from. So, I mean, there are a lot of ways to obviously harm people. We know that. The question is, what's the best way for us as a society to protect the integrity of our political process on the one hand and the freedoms that we have, but on the other hand, protect our safety? Safety should be extremely important to us. It's just getting to that final resolution of how best to do that, it's very, very difficult.
Oh, speaking of freedoms, I did want to ask you about the U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to take up that ban on handguns in the District of Columbia. They'll hear that case sometime early next year. And a lot of people are saying that this is, you know, like the first time or at least the most in-depth examination of the Second Amendment and whether we have a collective or an individual right to bear arms.
Well, you know, it should be interesting to see. This is a very conservative Supreme Court, and so my sense is that they are not going to, you know, necessarily, you know, say that you can't carry handguns, except under some unique circumstances or conditions. We'll have to see how that case plays out. But the fact is that we've had these kinds of laws and proposals, and these court cases have come before the appellate courts before. So this is, in that sense, is not new. It depends on the particular issues of the case and how this court, which is very conservative, will respond. And we don't really have a good handle on that yet, so we'll have to stay tuned on that. Mm-hmm.
David in Dodgeville is with us now. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello. I just want to bring to everybody's attention when they took the guns away from the citizens in Canada, Australia, and France, the gun violence increased towards the citizens of their country.
Did it? Hold on, David. Do you know if that indeed is the case, Dean Strykovich?
Well, I don't know particularly that that's the case in those three countries, but I do know that those countries have very low rates of violence anyway because they have a different culture around the usage of guns. And their laws are much different in terms of who can have access to guns. So the fact of the matter is, if there was an increase, as suggested by the caller, it was probably minimal, and it was probably something that didn't go that high anyway, because that, those were societies that had very low rates of violence with guns.
Yeah, like right now, if we compare the U.S. to Canada, it's night and day, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And even though you may have pockets in Canada that there may be higher rates of violence, the fact of the matter is, in the aggregate, their rates of violence are very, very low. This is what distinguishes America from the rest of the world. When you look at specific kinds of crimes, it's the lethal violence where we are way off the charts in terms of, you know, the impact on our society. We're very similar in other countries in terms of robberies and burglaries and other types of traditional crimes. But when it comes to lethality, we are really off the charts.
Yeah. David, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to talk about that point you made.
Yeah.
Did you have something else to add or a follow-up?
Well, I know me living in the city and my dad being a farm kid, I mean, I was always taught how to handle guns ever since I was 5 years old. My biggest problem is a lot of these people that live in these rural or bigger cities, you know, don't teach their kids about guns. Gun safety, don't educate them at all about guns.
Mm-hmm. Dean Strykovich?
Well, like I said earlier, uh-huh. I think product liability product education is the route to go. If you're given the current political structure, people have to know more about it. You know, I went to University of Wisconsin-Platteville back in the mid-70s, and a lot of people had guns in the dormitories, but nobody ever got shot. Uh-huh. And I think a lot of it was what the caller is suggesting. Many of these students came from rural areas. They knew how to use weapons. They were used for specific purposes, hunting, and there's something to be said about that. And there's something to be said about the education provided people. And that's the issue. But that gets bogged down in a mire of practical problems, liability issues, and a lot of people just don't want to walk down that road.
Yeah, thank you, David. Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a comment in regards to this. I'm quite an avid hunter and a gun collector, and the big situation that I have with coming out and just banning guns throughout America here is the accessibility of guns that you can get actually at gun shows. You can walk into a gun show in the outer regions of like Milwaukee, Green Bay, La Crosse, and out in the country, get these guns, give the guy a couple $100 or whatever, he gives you a gun and you got it. No paperwork, no checking on you, no nothing. I think we need to reinforce the background checks, things like that. Right now, you don't have to wait to purchase a long gun, a rifle, shotgun, but you do have to wait for a handgun. What do you think about the gun shows and actually purchasing guns?
Well, you know, you bring up a good point. Gun accessibility through gun shows is a huge issue. Some call it a boon for the gun industry.
Others call it a huge problem in terms of the accessibility to weapons, something an earlier caller had talked about. I do believe that we need to look at how do people get access to guns via the gun shows. Because clearly, gun shows are loose, but every time we try to control the legislative process or try to impose that, strong, powerful lobbies oppose any kind of control of that. Until we as a collective in this society deem that as a problem significant enough to get political consensus, gun shows will be all over this country. And in fact, if you go to gun shows, and I've been to a couple of them, you'll see the ease with which people can access, as the caller suggests, weapons. And I think that that is a problem we need to attend to.
Yeah, and in our last 30 seconds, Dean Stojkovich, put these types of incidents in perspective. They are rare and usually deal with people with mental health problems.
Yeah, and we need to understand the political realities of this, too, and the availability of weapons in our society. We clearly have a lot of weapons that are available to people, both legally and illegally. And until we, again, come to some notion about how we want to control those weapons, it's going to be very, very difficult. It's going to be difficult anyway because there are just too many weapons already out there.
Stan Stojkovich, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.